It's one of the pitfalls of an island state, unequal access to medical care depending on where you live. Women who live on Kauai and wish to terminate a pregnancy cannot do so at home, even if they choose to do so with medication their doctor can legally prescribe. The American Civil Liberties Union is embroiled in a legal battle to make that medication available everywhere through a lawsuit filed by Kauai physician Dr. Graham Chilius. Julia Kay, an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union's Reproductive Freedom Project, explained the ACLU's case to us in an interview last week.
Kauai has no abortion providers, but it is not for lack of having qualified clinicians who want to provide this care. The lead plaintiff in a lawsuit that the ACLU filed against the Federal Food and Drug Administration in October is a family medicine doctor on Kauai who wants to provide medication abortion care to his patients who need it. Mm-hmm. But because of medically unjustified, politically motivated restrictions on the abortion pill imposed by the FDA, he cannot.
This is somebody who wants to prescribe the abortion pill as opposed to a procedure.
That's exactly right. So the abortion pill is a safe and effective medication. Over the past 18 years, 3 million women in the United States have used it to end an early pregnancy, up to 10 weeks. And by the FDA's own admission, in their own words, serious complications relating to the abortion pill are, quote, exceedingly rare. But nonetheless, the FDA imposes burdensome restrictions on this medication that dramatically limit its availability.
What is their rationale? What is the FDA's rationale for those restrictions?
Well, it defies common sense. Not only has the FDA acknowledged how safe this medication is, but when you look at the restrictions themselves, and I'm happy to explain what those are, they simply don't make any sense. They defy logic. So the principal restriction is on where a patient can fill a prescription for the abortion pill. Now, it's important to remember that a woman is already allowed to take the medication that's been prescribed to her and swallow it at home. There are no restrictions on where she has to be located when she swallows the pill.
It's about access.
It's about where she has to be standing when she's handed this pill that's been prescribed to her. So these restrictions say that a patient can only receive this medication, just to say that again, these restrictions say that a patient can only receive this medication in a hospital, clinic, or medical office. She cannot fill a prescription for the abortion pill, brand name Mifeprex, in a pharmacy. So what that means in practice is that a clinician who wants to write a prescription for the abortion pill to their patients has to prearrange to order and stock and dispense the medication on site at their healthcare facility. But for a variety of reasons, many clinicians can't get approval to do so. They would have to get sign-off from multiple individuals and committees within their institution because stocking a medication on site is so unusual and requires the involvement of many more people.
I'm still not getting the reason for the FDA having this reg in the first place.
You and me both.
But I mean, they had a reason. There has to be a stated reason, right?
They have not given any reason beyond, in the broadest terms, that this is purportedly necessary for patient health and safety. But it simply defies logic. There is exactly zero safety benefit to requiring that a woman be standing in a clinic or a hospital rather than a pharmacy when she's handed a pill that she'll then take and swallow at home.
Somebody thinks otherwise, I would think. I mean, there had to be. I'm just trying to get to a reason why this came about.
I understand, and I am telling you as much as I know. And as this case proceeds, the FDA will do its best to try to articulate some defensible reason for these harmful restrictions, but they have not done so yet.
You haven't heard any counter argument to this, really?
No. And it simply, when you just examine the restrictions themselves and the FDA's own admissions about how safe and effective this medication that 3 million women have used, it doesn't make any sense to single this out. it is clear that this is not about science. This is about politics and ideology. And meanwhile, these restrictions are harming patients in Hawaii and all across the country.
Well, in litigating this, the other side is going to have a counter argument, right?
I presume so.
What's that going to be?
I look forward to seeing what the FDA will come up with to try to justify these restrictions. But on their face, just when you just hear what they are, it is clear that they do not make sense and that this is really just about politics.
So on the island of Kauai, if you want to get an abortion, you have to either have to have a procedure or you have to leave the island to get access to the abortion pill.
There also are no providers of surgical abortions on Kauai. There are no abortion providers, period, on Kauai. So patients who need any kind of abortion care have to fly to Oahu for that care. Now, there is one caveat, which is that right now there is a temporary study underway that the University of Hawaii is participating in which medication abortion is mailed to patients following video conferencing with the healthcare provider who examines their charts and blood work, et cetera, mm-hmm. And then mails the medication to them. So right now, that study is providing some temporary relief to some patients who are eligible to participate. But again, it is not a cure-all for all patients, and it's time-limited. This is a long-term problem that in particular harms low-income patients on the island for whom it can simply be impossible to find the funds and the childcare and the time off work and everything that it takes to fly to another island for this time-sensitive care.
Is this reflected in other parts of the country?
Yes, these restrictions apply nationwide. We know that all across the country there are what's known as abortion deserts, where there are simply no providers of abortion for hundreds of miles. As we speak, there are 8 states that have only one abortion clinic left serving the entire state, and that is because of similarly burdensome and medically unjustified restrictions and regulations that just push these clinics out of business, force them to close their doors. So it is a very troubling state of affairs nationwide. If these FDA restrictions are removed, it will significantly expand access to this safe and effective medication because qualified clinicians will be able to simply write a prescription for a patient who needs this care that the patient can then fill at a pharmacy of her choice, rather than having to take on the burdens of trying to stock and dispense the medication on site, which many simply can't do.
Are there other lawsuits around the country? Similar lawsuits?
Well, we have a lot of litigation right now relating to access to abortion, both at the state and federal level. This is the only lawsuit in the country challenging these FDA restrictions. And if we're successful here in Hawaii, it will be a game changer nationwide.
If as you describe, the counter arguments don't amount to much of anything, that shouldn't be that difficult, right?
I am very hopeful that we will ultimately prevail and be able to expand access and remove these harmful restrictions that right now are delaying or altogether blocking patients' access to this medication.
You have a great many states, certainly on the mainland, where opposition to abortion is pretty strong.
That is correct. In fact, just to share a few examples, Iowa very recently banned all abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy, a point in pregnancy when most women don't even yet know they're pregnant.
How would you even know? Yeah.
Exactly. Kentucky and Arkansas and a number of other states have banned the safest and most common method of second trimester abortion. Mississippi banned abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. And that is just the tip of the iceberg. Not to mention everything that's happening at the federal level. The attacks on abortion rights and access right now at both the state and federal levels are unprecedented.
The Kauai case that you describe the way you describe it seems from your perspective, from the point of view of the argument you're making, to be extremely winnable if there is no really strong counter argument. But the climate of the nation is going pretty wholeheartedly against you, isn't it?
Well, I think that we are seeing politicians imposing greater and greater restrictions on abortion. I think at the legislative level, at the policy level, we are seeing unprecedented attacks. But when you actually poll the public, you're not seeing any sort of equivalent move away from respecting patients' rights to access this medication. So I really think that what we're seeing from politicians is out of touch with where folks across the country are on this issue, which is believing that women should not face unjustified obstacles to obtaining safe and necessary health care.
Julia Kay is an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union's Reproductive Freedom Project. She says the current litigation could take several more years. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, looking at the volcano's impact on solar panels. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking of someone very close to the tobacco heiress, socialite, and philanthropist Doris Duke. Dubbed the world's richest girl in her lifetime, Duke led an adventurous and at times tumultuous life that eventually brought her to Hawaii. Here, the jet setter was taught to surf by another Duke, Kahanumoku, that is, and his brothers, and was the first non-Hawaiian woman to take part in competitive surfing competitions. In the shadow of Diamond Head, she built her famed estate, Shangri-La, as a testament to Islamic art, and in death, she persists in Hawaii as one of the island's greatest patron of the arts. Toward the end of her life, she had amassed a fortune of over $1 billion, and just prior to her death, entrusted the entire of her wealth and estate to one man, her butler. For today's backyard quiz, what's the name of the butler that Doris Duke entrusted her $1.2 billion fortune to? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Urgent Care Hawaii, walk-in clinics in Pearl City, Kailua, Kapolei, and Waikiki, featuring ZipPass, a new online tool to secure a place in line. AmazingUrgentCare.com.
On Hawaii Island, officials have been meeting with residents of neighborhoods affected by the fog and noxious gases to address concerns about air quality. But if you live in an area that's being affected by the volcano, should you be concerned about the corrosive effects of volcanic ash, Pele's hair, and acid rain on things like your solar panels? The head of the Hawaii Island Energy Cooperative, Marco Mangelsdorf, talked to us about just that.
Certainly interesting times for anybody who lives on the Big Island, whether you're east, west, north, or south. But in terms of people who own solar systems, of which there are tens of thousands here on this island, both solar hot water and solar electric, I think maybe the first thing to know or to keep in mind is that when there's soot or ash in the air, this particulate matter, 2.5 microns or less, that's coming from especially the eruption at Halemaumau, Kilauea volcano, that when that combines with water, and if it happens to be misty, rainy, drizzly, and it's on your roof, and we have a lot of roofs here on this island that are metal roofs, that makes for an extremely dangerous environment when it comes to walking on roofs. It'll turn it incredibly slick. So if anybody has any idea, well, gee, I should get up on my roof and clean my solar panels off, I would exercise extreme caution because of that slipperiness. So I think that's point number one, because we all want to be safe is top priority.
That's right, yeah.
And then in terms of acid rain, which is created when you have hydrogen sulfide and or sulfur dioxide, which are both coming from the volcanic eruptions along the East Rift Zone in the Pune area, and that's carried down south typically, down the south, the east side of the island, and then around the southern tip, and actually blows up and can turn air quality on the Kona side into Los Angeles on a bad day, is that solar modules, whether they're PV, photovoltaic, or whether they're solar hot water, are made of robust materials, typically glass, which is highly resistant to corrosion, and anodized aluminum, which is also very resistant to corrosion. So in terms of acid rain causing your solar panels, your solar array to disappear before your very eyes, that's certainly not going to happen. In terms of keeping them clean, we always recommend that no abrasives, no solvents be used, and if you're going to wipe them off, use something soft and a little bit of diluted detergent. But typically, a hose with a pressure nozzle, if you can reach it from the ground, or maybe just prop up a ladder along the edge of the roof, don't get on the roof, but and try to get access to your solar array. So I think, generally speaking, Catherine, I don't think it's much of an issue.
Well, I remember when we installed our system, that's what our company said, you know, just basically hose it down every now and then. But really, it was supposed to be kind of maintenance-free.
Well, and it is, especially in areas that get a fair amount of rainfall, which most of this island does. So typically, the natural rinsing off effect of rain makes it so that very relatively few solar system owners really have to do much of anything. So, yeah, I mean, for all intents and purposes, it is fairly maintenance-free.
And if you do need help, or are concerned, if you live in the areas around where the there is kind of heavy ash, you know, should you just call your solar company?
Sure. I mean, Provision Solar is happy to provide whatever guidance we can to folks who are concerned in the affected areas. In fact, a number of our customers in the volcano area have also already contacted us and asked pretty much that same question: what should I do? Is there anything I should do? So I would tell them pretty much the same thing that that I'm just telling you, that, mm-hmm. you know, of all the things that are worth perhaps being concerned about in these challenging times, your solar panels being damaged by soot or sulfur dioxide or hydrogen sulfide, that shouldn't really be too top of mind awareness or too high in terms of the list of concerns.
Okay, and I know that there, you know, is concern about the acid rain on, let's say, catchment systems where they might have you know, a lot of exposed metal. But what about, like, the brackets or the clips that hold the panels on your roof?
Well, they're typically also used. Those products are of an aluminum grade or a type of aluminum which is resistant to corrosion. Now, granted, any type of metal, even stainless steel, when you have it within a corrosive environment, which is all along coastlines because of the saltwater spray, there's going to be an acceleration of corrosion, and there's not a whole lot that people can do, really. I mean, these systems are designed to be in these kind of environments for decades. So, you know, very few things in life last forever, and solar equipment does not, but typically anything that's outdoors, which of course solar arrays are, including the mounting hardware and the solar panels themselves, are made of robust materials which are designed for those types of environments to last for years and years.
And as far as, let's say, folks on the neighbor islands, you know, that aren't, you know, really so much impacted by the VOG, any concern there?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so, although, you know, as we know, those of us who live in the islands, when the typical trade winds, which come from the northeast, slow down or disappear, which happens on a on an infrequent basis, but when it does happen, then we get the so-called Kona winds, and then what's happening on this volcano, this volcanic island, gets pushed up north across the chain. But in terms of affecting solar system performance or degradation of the system, that's not something that I would be concerned about.
When you say these panels are kind of designed to withstand a lot of the elements, I mean, does it also make a difference as to where they come from, if they're from China or U.S. made?
Well, given the fact that close to 70% of the entire global market in terms of photovoltaic system modules is coming from China or Taiwan, I mean, they are the largest player in the world. And I would say maybe 10, 15 years ago, there were certainly legitimate greater questions regarding the quality of workmanship and the materials the Chinese were putting out. But they, I think, have learned a lot over the years. So whether the solar modules are made in China or Malaysia or the Philippines or the little amount of manufacturing we have in the U.S. or India or Japan, I'd say overall the standards and the quality of this equipment is quite high.
Okay, well, that's good to know. All right, anything else homeowners should know, property owners should know?
Well, just to keep in mind those who are suffering. I mean, I have my home. I have my home intact here in Hilo, although I can say, you know, I get up on my second floor at Lanai, and I can see 20 miles away. 20 miles away, I can actually see the glow of the eruption, and I feel such a sense of sadness for those who have lost their homes or who have been chased from their homes, who are living in tents, who are living at shelters and so forth, that, you know, lucky we live Hawaii, no doubt. But at the same time, you know, we live life on the edge, and we just have to do the best we can, especially those who are so directly impacted by volcanic activity.
That's true. Marco, thank you. Thanks for sharing your expertise with us.
It's been my great pleasure, Catherine. Thanks for having me on.
That was Marco Mangelsdorf of the Hawaii Island Energy Cooperative. To find out more, visit the Conversation Facebook page.
Support for The Conversation comes from Honolulu Waldorf School on Oahu and Haleakala Waldorf School on Maui, serving Hawaii's families from infancy with parent-child programs through high school, now accepting applications at both schools.
Summertime, and with that comes much hotter weather and less rain. A story in Civil Beat today looks at the city's use of water in our parks. Chad Blair joins us with more on the results of a recent audit. Morning, Chad.
Good morning, Catherine.
So tell us about this audit.
Right. This comes from our reporter, Bianca Smallwood, and she looked at an audit from the city auditor, not the state, but the city auditor, and there was a goal to have to reduce the use of potable water. And by that, we mean water that's suitable for drinking. So the goal was to reduce its usage by 5% over a year. Well, that didn't happen. Not only did that not happen, instead, the use of potable water in parks actually increased 13%. This is over the previous two fiscal years. Why is that important? Well, if you had stuck with that original 5% goal, we would have saved, meaning the city, meaning taxpayers, over $800,000. Instead, by using much more water than was planned, it's going to cost us up to $2 million.
I mean, that really is staggering.
Yeah.
But I know, I mean, I frequent the parks, and I know that we've had folks, a lot of the homeless camps tap into the water. I've seen, you know, paddlers hook up their hoses to
sure.
hose down their boats. I mean, the water gets used a lot in those parks.
Right. And it, of course, everybody wants to do that. They want to take a shower after swimming. But there was actually some advice to the Department of Parks and Recreation. That's the agency that we're referring to here, that they actually should have installed water conserving fixtures or even irrigation equipment. If they had done that, they would have saved that money. There's another recommendation that came from the auditor as well. Use non-potable water. In other words, water that is not suitable for drinking but could be used to water the grass and so forth when possible. But that didn't happen. In fact, according to Bianca's article, and this actually astounded me, only 7 out of 440 city parks. First of all, I didn't know that we had 440 city parks on Oahu, but only 7 of those have used non-potable water or recycled water as a source.
Right, because I think that's used in for irrigation in a lot of places. I think golf courses.
Right.
So that is interesting.
Yeah, it stands out.
And the fact that something as simple as low flow, either, you know, toilets or shower heads, that's not a expensive fix, I would think.
It would think so. Now, what the Department of Parks and Recreation is saying is that they are working with the Board of Water Supply to see if they can come up with mechanisms. But there is, in fact, no formal plans in place regarding the use of potable water. I should say, in Bianca's article, the audit found another problem, referring to the city, that only 76% of its positions in this particular agency had been filled. In other words, there were a lot of vacancies. Why is that important? Well, when you're hiring temporary contractors, that actually will cost you more than having permanent people in place. In part, it has to do with turnover, right? It costs more to fill these spots. So a couple of different things in the defense of the department's response, by the way. They said they do agree with the auditor's findings.
Right, but if you need groundskeepers to to turn off the water, that would be important as well.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll see going forward whether the department, the city, actually adopts these recommendations.
Yeah, and it would be interesting to see what the use is for the state as well.
Exactly.
All right, Chad. Thanks so much. That was Honolulu Civil Beat's Chad Blair with today's Reality Check. To read the full story about the water audit, visit civilbeat.org.
This woman is a potato farmer in the mountains of Peru. She and her neighbors are trying to stop a company from blowing up hillsides and digging deep into the earth. She says it's damaging the environment. Right now, she's all that stands between the company and the gold underneath her own farm. And she says she's not giving up the fight. Our story from the Peruvian Andes on the world.
This afternoon at 1.
Coral reefs all over the world are under siege from various human impacts. And Maui's reefs are among those that have been hard hit by runoffs, land-based water pollution. It's a far cry from the days when the Ahupua'a system of pre-contact days kept that runoff under control. Jennifer Vandervoer, Maui Program Manager for the Coral Reef Alliance, or CORAL, is giving a talk later this week on restoring the natural function of Maui's Ahupua'a to protect Maui's coral reefs. We spoke earlier this morning.
Over time and through different development and agricultural practices, a lot of the function of the Ahupua'a has been broken. Traditionally, Ahupua'a are the land divisions from Malcolm Lakai that are from the mountains to the ocean that are connected generally around a freshwater resource, streams, and whatnot. And when we started diverting water from the streams weren't actually flowing to the ocean anymore. And then we started to develop land around the area, clearing a lot of the natural vegetation that held the ground, held the land together. And through that, these systems have become degraded and broken and don't really function.
Systems meaning enough sediment coming into the ocean, going into the ocean, but not too much, huh?
Well, also just a stream flowing from the mountain to the ocean. Mm-hmm. Most of our water has been diverted, so we don't even have streams that reach the ocean anymore.
So they're diverted how? What's an example of that?
A lot of different old ditch systems were created to channel water from one part of the island to another where agricultural was done. And so most of the water diversions were due to industry and making sure that agriculture and different areas had water.
Is this a function of post-contact Hawaii then?
Yes, indeed it is, yeah. Prior to that, any water that was diverted from the streams for lo'i, and that was actually redirected back into the streams. And so even though water was utilized traditionally outside of the stream, it always re-entered the streams, and streams were always reached the ocean.
It sounds as if at some point people moved away from a system that worked. What was it that was preferable to them in changing the way the water was being moved around?
Well, I don't know if it was necessarily preferred by the community, but specific stakeholders and businesses that would divert that. And mm-hmm. So it was basically post-contact. You have businessmen that come in and change the whole function of ecosystems and the community by diverting water for different agriculture and other commercial activities.
So this is kind of a function of industrialization, a little bit of the industrialization of agriculture?
Yeah, definitely.
Well, how do you reverse a trend that is at least a couple of centuries old?
Well, first we need to get the water actually flowing back into the streams again. And Aaron Strotz of the Commission on Water Resource Management for the state of Hawaii is doing an excellent job of that. He's going to each of the streams and making sure that diversions are stopped or minimized so that there's a minimum flow standard, which basically means that there's enough water in the streams that the streams will actually reach the ocean. So working with partners like that and making the community aware of the incredibly important functions of streams and how they do connect the mountains and the ocean, and that this fresh water brings life to the plants, animals, but also the seaweed and marine life. There's fish that depend on fresh water for parts of their life cycles. So without that fresh water reaching the ocean, we're really crippling multiple ecosystems.
What's the effect of excessive amounts of sediment reaching the ocean?
When you have excessive amounts of sediment, there's also a lot of nutrients tied up in that sediment. So in addition to having this dirt come and smother the corals and block the light that the little algae, the zooxanthellae in the coral tissues need, the sediment blocks that light so that they can't photosynthesize the size and produce energy for the corals. That sediment also creates a barricade so that the corals can't filter feed to get food. So ultimately, they're stressed. They can't, and then they can bleach. And once coral bleach, most of the time it dies. So in addition to that, you're introducing all these excess nutrients that enable algae and limu to grow. And in West Maui, that was such a big problem in the past that they actually had to bulldoze seaweed off of the beaches because there was so much nutrients and so much fertilizers in these areas that the algae, they can grow quicker and they can outcompete the coral, which will actually shift the ecosystem from a coral reef to an algae or seaweed-dominated ecosystem.
What is it that creates that much excess of sediment in the first place? Is this runoff after a particularly powerful storm, or what does that?
it's definitely runoff from big storms. But what happened was when these areas were being developed for agriculture, they were making a lot of dirt roads. And when they would make the dirt roads, they would basically push all the dirt and sediment either into the gulches or along the edges of the gulches. And then they would also make these things called kickouts, which were intended to divert water off the road so the road doesn't get chewed up. But a consequence of that is that it became basically a highway for sediment to be transported. The water can run really fast over these barren roads. There's no plants to break up that energy. The velocity of that water increases. It picks up the sediment, and then it goes off the gulches into the streams, and it's taking some of those push piles or legacy sediments with it into the stream. And then ultimately, when we have those big flash flood, heavy rain events, all that sediment is washed downstream.
Could the damage that causes have been foreseen?
I think that ultimately what happens is we have these big brown water events. And so the idea of, you know, being able to connect we're pushing all the pile into the streams and going out into the ocean and seeing these brown water events, I think that it you know, probably wouldn't have taken too long to see the impacts of that. It's hard to tell, but there are ways to mitigate it now. One of the things that we're looking at doing is reversing those kickouts. So instead of going off the edge of the gulch, they go back into the land, and that helps with reducing the sediment going off, but it also helps with groundwater infiltration. The longer we keep water on the ground, the more likely or more able it is to seep back into the ground and then recharge our aquifers and provide water for the plants and all of that.
It sounds as like a fairly large education program is in order.
Yes. Yeah. So it's definitely one of the aspects that Coral works with is educating not only the community and stakeholders, but, you know, developers and engineers and people that are going to create more infrastructure and how we can do it in a way that is more reef-friendly and does mitigate some of the heavy runoff events.
Jennifer Vanderveer is the Maui Program Manager for the Coral Reef Alliance, or CORAL. She will speak on restoring the natural function of Maui's Ahupua'a to protect Maui's coral reefs Wednesday evening at the Maui Nui Marine Resource Council meeting. The free talk will be offered in the Pacific Whale Foundation's classrooms downstairs at the Ma'alai Harbor Shops from 5 to 6:30 p.m.
I'm Kimberly Atkins. Coming up on the next On Point, Robert Kennedy took on poverty across racial lines. 50 years after his assassination, we'll look at that legacy. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 2.
Earlier on this program, we asked you to think of what became of the fortune of famed socialite and philanthropist Doris Duke. Her estate was worth over $1.2 billion at the time of her death. The Doris Duke Foundation founded several charitable initiatives to promote art in Hawaii, including installations at the Honolulu Museum of Art and the transformation of her former Diamond Head estate, Shangri-La, into a museum displaying Islamic art and architecture. The executor and inheritor of this will, however, wasn't any member of the Duke family, but instead her butler, Bernard Lafferty. A poor orphan from County Donegal, Ireland, Lafferty served other high-profile celebrities like Sophia Loren and Elizabeth Taylor before becoming Duke's butler in 1987, as well as her closest friend.
And, Chris, you know that we had lots of calls. This was a very popular quiz, but congratulations to Robert Smith from Hilo. He was the first to call. Congratulations again. And that is today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, a literacy program available to Hawaii students in grades pre-K through 12, offering Home Edition, with parent support in 21 languages. Achieve3000.com.
Many Pacific Island nations look to Hawaii as a model for what to do and not to do when it comes to tourism. This summer, the East-West Center launched a new course of study thanks to a $250,000 grant from the State Department's Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs. Pacific Island fellows have been immersed in a six-week intensive in the islands and made a trip to Washington, D.C. over Memorial Day weekend to meet other cohorts in our nation's capital. We sat down with one of the Pacific fellows, Papua New Guinea's Pauline Rinman, to share her first impressions about our visitor industry and what she will take back to her island. What struck you about Hawaii when you first arrived here?
How big it was, yeah. The city and so many people from all over the world, yeah.
And Papua New Guinea has a fledgling tourist industry.
Yeah, that's right.
So you're here to kind of learn the do's and don'ts, what we do right and what we've done wrong, and to learn from our mistakes.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Since I've been here, I've started an internship with a nonprofit called Travel to Change. And what they do is create fun and impactful activities for travelers who come to Hawaii. And they build positive experiences that also help they like to refer to themselves as travelers, giving back to the Hawaiian community. But ideally, what we'd like to bring back to our own countries is how to be better leaders and better leaders for change. So we're hoping to get some knowledge and an experience from those that can provide us a path or strategies to achieve our goals and our plans for our countries.
And so explain to our listeners what the tourist industry is like in Papua New Guinea.
The industry in Papua New Guinea is, because we have such a vast country, we're kind of fragmented, but we are looking at ways to come together and build one goal that we can all achieve together. And I work for our National Tourism Organization, and it's been a difficult job trying to, you know, build bridges between our industry pockets in the different provinces. So my experience here in Hawaii is trying to see how you guys do it, how you guys work together.
And why is it difficult? Are we talking different cultures?
Yes, because Papua New Guinea we have 1,000 different tribes and 800 languages. So communication and maintaining it has been a challenge for us, yeah.
And I know here it's important to have the authentic culture properly highlighted, mm-hmm. because there are lots of, I think, misconceptions about what Hawaii is all about, that they think it's just all, you know, sand and surf and sunshine, and the culture is much deeper than that.
Mm-hmm.
So I imagine that you folks then have that same challenge.
Yes, yeah. Trying to maintain our cultural authenticity, that's one thing that we're trying to maintain and not let outside influences, I don't know, commercialize it too much, or, you know, maintain its integrity. Yeah.
Right, and the country has so much to offer. I mean, what I've read and seen online, just, you know, marvelous cultural experiences are available to folks who are adventurous.
Yeah, that's right. We are a hard adventure destination. So we have things like trekking and surfing and diving, not the soft adventures like Hawaii does. But, it's a very bold experience if you want to come to PNG. Yeah, it challenges you.
And so what has this experience been like for you as you've gone around to see just different facets of our tourist industry?
Yes. It's been an eye-opener. I've seen a lot of things that Hawaii has, and it's some things that I do find wonderful that I could take back, and some things that I'd really not like to maybe take back to PNG. Yeah.
Or you can learn how to avoid.
Yes, that's
the
right.
Problems.
Exactly.
If you want to give us an example, what maybe you think won't fly in your country? What would you like to avoid?
Yes, maybe it's the cultural part. Yeah, there's some things that I wouldn't like to commercialize too much, just to keep sacred. And then there's the number of tourists coming in. There's just so many.
Right.
Yeah, I don't think we'd be able to handle that.
Right. We're seeing record numbers here, and we don't have enough hotel rooms.
Yeah.
And that's created a whole host of problems. We do get, really millions coming through here. What's the scale for Papua New Guinea? Like, how many tourists do you folks get?
Last year, we got about 189,000 plus tourists. And the majority of them were business travelers. Yeah, about 90,000 of those. In terms of marketing, I see that Hawaii and of the organization that I'm with, they use the digital online platforms to market Hawaii and the different activities. And I think that would be a great a take home for me to bring back to Papua New Guinea and look at platforms, online platforms that we can better market our destination.
With Papua New Guinea, how is that broken up? I mean, are there more areas that are more rugged, maybe up in the highlands that are more difficult to get to?
Yeah, Papua New Guinea is a difficult place to get around. The only way you can get around PNG is by air. Yeah, not like Hawaii, you can get on a car or a bus or a boat. But PNG, it's mainly air travel. Yeah.
So there are challenges there.
That's right.
And as far as airlines coming through there, are there multiple, or is there a monopoly out there?
We have three commercial airlines, but our national carrier is the Air New Guinea. Yeah, our country is also looking at ways of opening up our roads and increasing sea transport as well. You know,
so really improving the infrastructure.
That's right. Yeah, the experience has brought a lot of insight into what's being done here in Hawaii, and I've learned a lot about the tourism and the sustainability tourism that Hawaii is moving towards or is currently doing right now. And I'd like to take that back home to PNG. And I'm sure my colleagues who are part of the Professional Fellows, Tourism Professional Fellows Program are doing would like to do the same.
That was Pauline Riemann, an East-West Center Pacific Fellow from Papua New Guinea, who spent Memorial Day weekend in our nation's capital. She returns to Port Moresby to share her experience following a six-week intensive look at Hawaii's tourism industry. We might note that an APEC summit last week focused on increasing the numbers of women in management roles in the visitor industry, and Riemann appears to be off to a good start.